Okay, so observed signature of this kind of explosion have not yet been studied in detail. And by the term observed signatures, I mean nucleosynthetic features and light curves and the spectra, especially in optical ranges. So this is my motivation to examine our spherical explosion model, especially in this context. So here I'm talking about jet-like explosion, which is somewhere between jet and jet, according to Amy's description in the conference. Okay, this is jet and this is jet. So I'm examining this kind of model. This is, well, basically, this is showing some bipolarity in element and this density distribution, but still, the ejector are expanding into all the direction. So it's not very jet. So let me give a brief introduction on hypernovae. And observationally, these are broad line supernovae. A prototypical one is 1998 BW, and which was discovered in an error box of a gamma ray burst 980425. And what was interesting is that this guy showed a very peculiar early phase spectra compared to 94I, which is type 1C supernova. You see that these detailed features are not seen in BW. So our interpretation of this is that in BW, these lines are broad, so they are merged and result in this featureless structure. So in this interpretation, 90BW showed very broad absorption lines, so which means that this had a lot of high velocity materials. So it then means that it should have large kinetic energies. So this is our definition of hypernovae. So I mean that if a supernova shows a very high kinetic energy, let's say that by a factor of 10 or so larger than a canonical one, we call it a hypernova. So a pro tip for this guy, Yamamoto et al. Did a detailed modeling based on spherical explosion model using a spherical radiation transport scheme. And the conclusion is that the energy is actually large, at least 30 times the canonical, 30 times larger than the canonical value. And this is the ejector mass is about 10 solar mass dominated by oxygen, which means that initially the main sequence stage, the mass was about 40 solar mass according to evolutionary scenario. So this is massive and very energetic explosion. So after that, we have two other examples of supernovae spectroscopy confirmed in gamma bursts, and DH and 03LW. And interesting point is that these supernovae are all type 1C and all hypernovae. The energy is at least 10 times larger than the normal supernova. And the estimated main sequence mass is indeed large. So it may indicate that these supernovae are black hole forming supernovae. So my interest here is that if they could show any signature of asphericity, and if they show the signature of asphericity, then how this estimate, especially the energy, should be revised. And this is my motivation to examine aspherical exposure models, especially for hypernovae. So modeling non-spherical supernovae, and my aim is especially at comparison with observations. So to produce a model which can be compared with observations, we have to have many steps. First of all, we have to have distribution of density elements and radioactivities. And this had been done by our groups 2002 and 2003 by some simplified model, and lately Patrick Young and Amy and Chris are also doing similar things but with more sophisticated numerical scheme. So this is a good thing. So once we have this kind of density and element distribution, we'd like to examine how radiations are transported in the ejecta and how does it look like in optical and in gamma rays and so on. So first, we have to solve the high energy emission transport in the supernova ejecta in 2D or in 3D. And numerical scheme has been developed by different three groups in the context of supernovae. One is by myself, and one is by Amy, and one is by Peter Hoffrich. And after we computed the gamma transport, then some of them are then converted to optical photons. So next, we have to solve the optical photon transport in the 3D geometry. And this has been done by several groups. And for optical light curves, this is basically frequency independent. And well, using some simplified approximation, my group and Peter Hoffrich are solving optical light curves for 2D or 3D geometry. And for the spectral synthesis, also several groups are now attempting to develop a numerical scheme and compute some prototype template models. So this has been done by myself and by my other groups. And this is also been done by Cosma and Klaus Bronson. And I'm sorry. And this has also been done by Kazen et al. So but as you see, this is all of them are after 2000. So this is actually a relatively new topics. And our strength is that we're always somewhere in these diagrams. So we can basically do some consistent model from the beginning to the end. So this is a reference. Actually, we have been producing too much for only a single object, supernova 1990 BW. So now I'm talking about nucleosynthetic features. This is not very new, and what I'm talking about here is based on my group's work 2002 and 2003. And here, progenitor models are taken from Nomoto and Hashimoto 1988, I think. So this is a kind of simplified models, in a sense that the model assumes that explosion does take place. I mean, I didn't solve from the collapsing core. I mean, in this model, explosion energies is artificially injected as a collapsing core. So in this sense, it is more or less similar to 1D thermal bomb explosion by Tillman or 1D piston explosion by Woodley. But the main difference is that here I allowed that the injected energy can be angle dependent. So here I assume that the energy, more energy is injected towards some specific direction. So this is a kind of bipolar explosion. And this has been done in a parameterized way. So basically, in this model, I have three parameters. One is the progenitor, and another is exposure energy, and the last one is the efferency, which gives the ratio of the initial injected energy along this direction, this direction. So after this initial condition, after input this initial condition, we solved hydrodynamics of shock propagation in supernova progenitors to, well, And finally, we have this kind of homologous expansion structure, which is about 100 seconds, 1,000 seconds after this energy input. So basically, the spherical explosion has two effects for nuclear synthesis. One is a bit trivial thing, which is that the spherical explosion models produce spatial distributable elements or density distributable elements very different from spherical models. And the other thing is not very trivial. This is that the overall integrated yield is normal, is now different from spherical model. This is a bit maniac figures, but you know, this figure is just a snapshot of shock propagation in the progenitor star. I think the surface of the progenitor is around here. It's still in the progenitor star. And this panel is maximum temperature versus maximum density after the shock propagation of each Lagrangian particle. I mean, this each point represents one position in this figure. And for example, this point was initially along this direction. And after shock propagation, it experienced a very strong shock, so it experienced very high temperature. And particle initially at this around this experienced a weaker shock, so the maximum temperature is smaller. And in this direction, the materials experience a lower temperature than in this direction because the shock is weak here. And what is interesting here is that in spherical model, this is basically a line. But in a spherical model, we have spread here. And what is interesting is that in this direction, the shock is weak, so the temperature is lower. And because the shock is weak, they tend to be more easily accreted onto the central remnant finally. For example, these green points are particles which I estimated that they are finally accreted onto the central remnant according to the balance of the escape velocity and the velocity at the end of simulation. So you see, here in this kind of model, materials experience with higher temperatures are more easily ejected, more selectively ejected. So it's very different from spherical symmetric expectation, because in spherical exposure models, the inner region got high temperature, but inner region tends to be more easily accreted onto the central remnant. So in this case, in spherical models, low temperature materials are selectively ejected. So this is different. So because the strength of the shock is angle dependent, we have inhomogeneous element and density distribution. Here we have a lot of burning silicon burning products, and especially dominated by 56 nickel in this direction. And on the other hand, in this direction, in equatorial directions, we have mainly oxygen, which was in the progenitor star itself, and we have disk-like structure here. And because of this, a kind of selection effect in hydrodynamics, the final yield in the ejector tends to be shifted toward heavier elements in spherical explosion than spherical explosion. For example, zinc, cobalt, titanium, which are basically produced by silicon burning, enhanced relative to iron for a spherical explosion. And this is actually not very special for this kind of model, because that a selection effect, I mean the ejection of higher temperature material, is a kind of general property of this kind of bipolar explosion. So this feature is, I think, not very sensibly dependent on a specific model. This is a kind of general feature I expect. And also we have the enhancement of alpha rate phase out. And for example, for titanium, which was talked in the conference by Amy. And well, these two lines are different to spherical models. And because we have the uncertainty in mass cut, we have basically line. I mean that if we go deeper, the nickel becomes large. Nickel becomes more massive. And at the same time, we have more titanium. So this is a line. And spherical models tend to produce more 44 titanium relative to iron than spherical models. And this is also true for the fixed zinc. So these are nucleosynthetic features. So I mean that the distribution and the final yields are different from spherical models. So the next step is the investigation to answer the question if whether these kind of explosions are really realistic or not. And the validity of this kind of model should be examined by comparison with observations. So my targets here are the prototypical hypernova 99. I'm sorry.
What
does
it say?
Well, this is say this PC is trying to update. And if we if I update, you know, I have to shut down, and so it will take 10 minutes. Okay, anyway, my target is 90 BW and the 2003 JD, which is more or less similar to 98 BW. So why should we revisit supernova 1998 BW again and again? Is that actually at this point, okay, let's say, at least at 2003, we didn't have a good model for 1998 BW, actually. I mean, at the first 2 months or so, spherical hypernova model of Iwamoto et al. Or Woosley et al. Was perfect to fit observations. You know, this point of that observed light curve, and this is model prediction, more or less similar to Iwamoto et al. However, at 1 year, we discovered that model light curve is no more, does not give a good representation of the observation. Here you see the difference about one magnitude or something. So my interest here was that to examine if spherical models can give good fit to light come from both here and here. Okay, and this this is a recent result from my data 2006B, which is still in the labeling process. So the this point again, the observation optical light curve, bolometric light curves of 1990 BW, and this black one is a spherical hypernova exposure models with the energy 50 times the normal run. Well, this is more similar to Iwamoto et al., but so it is basically gives a good representation of alpha light curves. The small difference here is is due to the fact that I didn't try to optimize the fit. For example, this lesion could be better fit by changing nickel distribution and so on. So anyway, I would say that this black one is more or less consistent with observations in early phase. And here you see that spherical models with exposure energy about 20 times the solar, 20 times the normal, which is about by a factor of 2.5 smaller than this model, also gives a good fit to the light curve. And this red line is a model with a viewing angle in this direction. And the blue is that in the same model but viewed in this direction. So here you see that the spherical model with a bit less energy, bit less energy can also explain the early phase light curve. So I'd say these two models are basically consistent with observed early phase light curves. And also we need to examine spectroscopic features, which I show here is photospheric velocity. Because in 2D case, the concept of photosphere is not very trivial. So I here wrote some model prediction, model estimate of the photospheric velocity distribution by color. Here's the red region, bright region, is basically the expected position of photosphere as a function of time. And then this red line is photospheric velocity derived from observed spectra. So here you see that very energetic spherical models is consistent with observation, which is of course consistent with earlier works by, for example, by Yamamoto et al. And the less energetic model doesn't give a good fit to the optical photospheric velocity. And that this model, a spherical model with 20 times the normal energy, built at this direction, also gives a good fit to the observation. Actually, this photospheric velocity, this evolution is actually consistent with the spherical models. So I'd say that in terms of photospheric velocity, these two models are also consistent with early phase observations. And what is a bit interesting is that, of course, it is a bit trivial, but in the spherical model case, the photospheric velocity depends on where we see the event, especially if we look at the event from this direction, the ejector velocity is high, so it gives a large photospheric velocity. So, viewing angle has another effect. This is on luminosity. This is the time evolution of the luminosity at a given angle divided by the mean luminosity. So, if we look at event from this direction, initially, we have very bright light curve by a factor of two brighter than the angle averaged luminosity. But then it goes down, and around the max peak date, we don't have this kind of viewing angle effect no more in luminosity. And this is an evolution of photosphere at 10 days, 20 days. This is around the maximum, and 30 days, 40 days in my models. And this is understandable because, you know, in the very early phase at 10 days here, if we look at this event from this direction, we have this surface area. But if we look at this from this direction, we just have this hamburger-shaped photosphere surface area. So you see the area here is larger than this, so it gives a larger luminosity in the early phase. However, at around the maximum, the photosphere is already more or less spherical, so it doesn't give a luminosity difference. So, my next question is, if which models are better to explain late phase observations? Well, these two lines are the models, very energetic spherical models, and very energetic, but less energetic than this one, the aspherical models. So you see that these two models are almost identical in the early phase, but it makes a difference in late phase. And you see that only the aspherical one built at the direction is consistent with observed light curve. And the reasons are not very difficult to understand, because this model has less exposure energy than spherical model. So this has a higher average density than this model. So it gives a large efficiency of trapping gammas in late phases. So it is brighter than this model in late phases. So in late phase, this model is actually okay as compared to the observation. And the final question is, is this consistent with late phase spectroscopy? Okay. For the black one spherical model, we already know that this is not very good to explain the light curve. And this is also, this model fails to explain nebula spectra. This gray one is observed spectrum of 1990 BW, around 1 year. And here you see, for example, this oxygen line is very sharply peaked in observation. However, this is very flat in model. And this flat model is expected from that emission from a shell. So this is not consistent to one another. However, the same model, this red one, produced a light, a model spectrum like this. And here, because we have the oxygen mass in a disc-like structure, if we look at this object from this direction, we have more emission in the left wavelength. So we have very we have very sharply peaked emission here, which is consistent with observation. So I would say this model is basically consistent with all the optical observation of 1990 BW, from very early phase to late phase at 1 year or something. So, and in this context, because we have spectroscopic information in early phase, in late phase, and the light curve information in early phase and in late phase, so I think we it's possible to narrow down the parameter range very tightly. And in the context of my model, the model parameters derived is that the main sequence mass is not very different from the earlier expectation. However, the energy is a bit smaller, by a factor of 2 or 3 smaller than spherical model expectation, and the viewing angle is close to the axis. And this model gives a nice fit to the optical observations. Okay, so this is, I hope this is the end of the story of 1980 BW. Just my hope. I'm already sick of from 1980 BW. Anyway, I'd like to point out another thing. Well, here, the blue one, this is the same model, but viewed at a different direction. You see this direction, and this is very kind of special. For example, this oxygen line shows doubly peaked profile, which is we never see in observed spectrum type 1 B supernovae.
30 degree angles consistent with the jet
that
you see.
I'm sorry.
I mean, maybe the jet from the gamma
burst
is more narrow than 30 degrees.
I didn't gamma burst. Well,
I mean, we saw the burst, right? So it could have been an R. Is that 30 degrees position?
Well, I mean, I see. Your point is that if this is consistent with the gamma burst or not.
Yeah.
Okay. I think basically this is constraint. Actually, I would say that it's very difficult to constrain the doing the angle very tightly. I mean the error here would be about 10 or 20 degree in this optical modeling.
Okay,
but I would say that the doing angle around 10 degree to 30 degree is basically consistent with optical observations, and I think this is basically consistent with the gamma burst 980425, a kind of consistent with off-axis emission model. For example, I think that the some persons are claiming that 90BW is off-axis GRB viewed from the direction about 15 degree or 13 degree. In this sense, which is this model is actually very consistent with gamma ray burst expectation.
Suppose you go completely on the axis, 0 degrees, how does it
change? Well, I see. In this model, the resolution of this model is not very good to examine this kind of thing. But my guess is that we don't have a very big difference in this direction, in this direction, because this is emission from non-relativistic ejector, so we don't have a beaming effect. So basically, well, this direction doesn't make a big difference in optical range, I think. Okay, one point, I'm going back. This is a kind of special, and this a model prediction, I mean that, if we look at this kind of object from equatorial direction, we should show look this kind of double peak special profile. And this was actually initially predicted in 2002 paper. And recently, 2004, we had a possible counterpart of this special for this kind of object. I mean, well, this is 2003 JD, which is in the early phase more or less similar to 90BW. However, in late phases, around 1 year, the spectrum was very different from that of 98BW. You see, 90BW was very sharp, had very sharply peaked octane profile, but 2003 JD had this kind of double peaked profile. And our interpretation, our suggestion is that this is more or less similar to 1990 BW intrinsically, but viewed from the different direction. Okay, this red one is a model prediction. Actually, it was already given in 2002 paper. This is very similar to the observed line profile. So I think this is another confirmation of this kind of spherical explosion models. And still there is a question, especially in radio. And the actual radio observation is not very consistent with the expectation of off-axis model. But because the radio, radio emission is, for example, very sensitive to the interstellar medium density, so I think we need more discussion to understand if this is really off-axis event or not, or something different. And I think this is the final one. And we also have, as a byproduct, have a high energy emission from this kind of hypernovae, where spectrum, line profile, and light curves. And I don't like to get into the detail of these things, but I just because there are basically no observation to date. And what is interesting is that these features are, for example, this feature, the spectrum shape, is very sensitive to its velocity, but it doesn't very dependent on viewing angle. And this line profile is mostly sensitive to viewing angle, and this light curve is sensitive to both spherical nickel mass and their energy. So, you know, these observers are dependent on different parameters in a different way. So if once we could observe these high-energy emissions, it could give a very powerful tool to examine nuclear synthetic feature in hypernova and supernova. And basically, qualitatively, these results are, I think, consistent with Amy's previous works. OK, so this is summary. For the nuclear synthesis, it has two effects. First, the distribution is no more spherical symmetric, of course. And especially silicon bonding product and the alpha leach freezer product, 56 nickel, 44 titanium, 56, which is decaying to zinc, is distributed in along the z-axis. And integrated yields are, as a consequence, very different from spherical exposure models. Especially, it gives enhancement of some d elements, like, for example, we have a larger ratio of 44 titanium to iron in the ejector. And this is not very dependent on a specific model. This is a kind of general feature of bipolar explosions. And emission processes. Now, at least a platform for 2D and 3D emission radiation numerical scheme has been developed, and it has been applied mainly to 90 dBw. And we found that the light carbon spectra in optical range are very different from spherical models. And for example, for 98 dBw, an spherical model actually gives a very good agreement with observation. And this should be the final. So. And we could narrow down the parameter ledge rather uniquely in this context, in the context of our models. And we find that the energy is less than expected from spherical models. But still, this is larger, much larger than canonical supernova by a factor of 10 or 20. And also, the same model gives a nice free to nebula emission line of 2003 JD, which is more or less similar to 98 dBw in the early phase. But still, we need a more detailed discussion on this object to understand the full story. OK, so that's it. Thank you very much.
Questions. Kenichi, sorry, when you mentioned, I missed that, sorry, two slides before this one.
Two slides. This one?
When you mentioned the integral detection of opportunity, detection possibility, would you refer, sorry, this is line detection or continuum?
This is line. Okay. I estimated in this paper.
Okay. And how did you estimate? Did you give? You have an estimate on the flux limit you should reach? Did you try to estimate? Because it's possible. We proposed successfully for supernovae with integral. Of course, the sensitivity.
But for type 1A.
Also for collapse.
Oh really? Well, here I just estimate the flux. I just compare the flux expected from this model with the flux limit of the integral, which I found in the web page, integral web page. And
it's a reasonable exposure time. how long exposure times you need?
Exposure time. Well, I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I think you guys followed
the same thing in the typical,
like,
annual,
like,
1 or 2 seconds or something.
Or
like
one
megasec,
one
megasec.
Yeah.
And then,
I
mean,
yeah.
The issue is that the lines are broad compared to the narrow lines.
Yeah.
So you only increase the narrow lines.
Yeah, you're right.
I'd like to go a little bit from the hypo-normal business into something which I thought was a really big development at this workshop, which is the people doing these numerical, sophisticated numerical simulations are now finding that the collapse, in fact, has more complexity in terms of the modes we saw, these acoustic waves or whatever. So the lesson there from there, it seems to me, is that these explosions will have asymmetries. And so it would be useful, it seems to me, to proceed in the subject the other way around. Not to start with sort of the most extreme example, VW, and that's it's polarized, and it's this, and it's that, and therefore GRBs, but to just in fact look, start modeling ordinary things, of which perhaps 2003 JD is an example, or 2002 AP, even more so. Because it's the nearest one, the signal to noise is highest, people get onto it early. Anyway, so my comment is, I think by sort of bringing in these more exciting possibilities, the basic interesting thing, the unique diagnostics of optical really lie in these sorts of signatures, and less on the hypernova stuff. And so that would be more interesting in my opinion.
Okay. I agree to the point that it's interesting to examine more typical supernova in the context of asymmetric explosion model. It is interesting, but yeah, my issue is just I'm quite new and I have been doing just 9BW. So my next step would be to go to another supernova, and which could be a more normal supernova. So.
No, I mean, I was making a slightly more subtle point than that, which is, let's leave us at GRB, is the rare phenomena, chance of just stumbling on one, you know, by accident is very low, 1 in 100 at the very least. So I'm talking the remaining 99, which is, I think, a good focus. The issue I'm asking is, we now have a better understanding from these numerical simulations that the asymmetries, which may have nothing to do with the formation of a black hole or any such thing, we're talking about many of those things are purely hydrodynamic effects we're talking about. So again, I want to leave aside this collapse and so on. Exciting as that may be, it's probably irrelevant for most supernovae. Is that they will create, these models show that there's this tremendous amount of asymmetry that's going on. And I want to understand, therefore, we take those are the starting points, okay? And they can't obviously go through the whole photospheric thing, which you're considering. Obviously, there's a big gap in between, which will be very difficult to model, okay? So the question I'm asking is, what can we now go backwards from these sorts of models to say something or trying to get a feel for what sort of rough asymmetries would be surviving from those explosions. But my worry is that this community having this huge focus on jets and collapses and gamma reverse, we're sort of missing actually what is really the actual development in this field, which is
This is kind of what Chris and I have been working on, trying to look at some of the milder asymmetries that are coming from the core collapse community directly, the mechanism.
Well, those collapses, the pictures I saw on Monday, they are all called cried, I don't call them mild at all. They're incredibly extreme.
So they're not magnetically driven very collimated at the very beginning. They're factors of 5 to 1 asymmetries in the velocity, and they're you know, polar in some way, in some direction, but at the level of 30, 40 degree opening angle. So that's milder than what the gamma ray community has been talking about. So that's what I was saying is these little, you know, more like a more typical jet of what we've seen. And the issue is, we're looking into those, there's to go from the mechanism regime, which is where you've got, you know, I mean, most of the mechanism calculations run out to the farthest one that I know is going out to like 2 seconds, and that's, you know, that's getting you pretty far. The issue is from 2 seconds to where you're breaking out of the star and you're actually getting a feel for what the density asymmetry would be, that these optical type data are probing. That's a big region. It's a lot of uncertainty in what the progenitor structure of the star is. It's just a very hard thing to go from that early time to the late time and be able to say with any real confidence without doing a lot of hydrodynamic models, how does that asymmetry propagate? And so, I mean, this is where we tried to get away with before. Well, okay, we can take something and put in the asymmetry at a later time, something like 100 seconds. And the issue is from 2 seconds to 100 seconds, you can argue that maybe the asymmetry stays at the level that it was that you saw in the mechanism calculation, but you're not guaranteed that that's the case. So, I mean, that's kind of where we're going, I think, and Keiichi's stuff, he's got the entire setup to start doing that. And now the idea is, the one piece, I mean, Keiichi was talking about doing this all in a very self-consistent way, and he has. The one piece that's missing from that self-consistent picture is to go from the mechanism people through to where you actually input the artificial asymmetry. Stop inputting it artificially, but start from the beginning. And that's something that I think we're all the different groups trying to get there. And that's the work we're doing. It just hasn't come out yet.
Yeah. So just to reiterate, all the groups are doing what you exactly just said. They're working on that for, you know, it's just
hard.
Since the gamma ray community just doesn't want to hear about them, you don't hear about them.
Well, for good reason, they would want to hear about them.
I mean, this was a problem which was around already for the 487A, actually. These flat line profiles, which we saw here, that was exactly what you got from the models of 87A. And I don't think we will really claim that's a gamma ray burst. So it had very nice peaked line profile in very much the same way as 98BW. I mean, the reason, and also the light curves didn't agree at all with any of these 1D explosions. And I mean, what we understood from that was that you needed very, very heavy mixing. And it was only with the 2 and 3D models where you really got this kind of mixing. And so I think I agree a bit with Trey's comment that one shouldn't just jump on the jet interpretation directly, because you have even these normal supernovae do give effects on line profiles, light curves, which are quite different from the 1D models.
Can I have a question for you?
Yeah.
The 1D results that you're showing here, are they the spherical explosions that you're showing? Are they spherical energy explosions done in 2D or done in 1D?
Done in 2D.
In 2D. Okay.
Yeah. But well, so here in this kind of calculation, in this my calculation, the resolution is not very high, so I didn't catch the, for example, Rayleigh Taylor mixing.
Oh, you didn't.
So, okay, so.
Did you estimate to which extent the spherical explosions affect the absolute maximum of Taiwan VC supernova?
Oh, sorry,
affect the absolute maximum of Taiwan VC supernova. I mean, my point is the following. As you know, supernovae associated with GLB may have this 5 magnitude dispersion at massive light.
Yeah.
So I want to know how much is due to intrinsic differences in the progenitors, and how much is just a pure geometrical effect.
Okay, so you are talking about the maximum luminosity in optical range. Okay.
Okay.
I think I have
from your figures. I have estimated about 1 magnitude.
Okay. In this model used to 90 BW, actually around the maximum, the angle doesn't affect very much the luminosity. Okay, let's say this is the model built along this direction, and the blue one is actually the same model built along equatorial direction. Here you see that around the peak it doesn't make big difference by a factor of 20 or 30%. The difference according to the viewing angle is just 20 or 30% in this model. So if we, for example, look at the magnitude difference in one magnitude in at the maximum right, according to this model, this should be intrinsic, not geometrical effect.
So this 5-magnitude dispersion is basically due to intrinsic differences in the progenitor?
I believe this luminosity difference is mostly intrinsic, because you know that basically the optical, this is, we are looking at a non-relativistic ejector. We don't have a relativistic beaming. So, and around the peak, we don't have big difference depending on the viewing angle.
So in the photospheric velocity plots, how would, if you were allowing the material along the pole to cool preferentially, because that's where a lot of the luminosity is coming from, you don't have the back reaction on the material, but if you were letting it cool and things were recombining and the opacity is dropping there, how would that change how the photospheric velocity sweeps back through the ejector?
Well, back reaction to the
in
this simulation, all the back reactions not included.
They're not included
in this simulation.
So if by the pools cooling preferentially, you would tend to have a recombination and thus a lower opacity along the pool, so that should play with the photospheric velocities.
Well, it could affect. Well, and there, it could affect the photospheric velocity, and there it. But in this case, this is type 1B shear, and I guess that radiation pressure effect on dynamics basically negligible.
Right, on the dynamics, but it should affect what the temperatures are and the ionization state, and since electron scattering is your primary opacity.
It is true, yeah, but here I'm using just a simplified opacity description.
And
so
it's likely to only matter in the early phase.
Yeah, I agree. But I would say this is still a kind of platform and still being developed, this kind of quality being developed. And actually, the, including this kind of more physics you are talking about is, I think, the next step.
You know, these other big profiles, do you see many other lines than in the oxygen one line?
We saw it in magnesium 44,000. 570. Well, because this is just one spectrum and it doesn't show many features. Here, this is oxygen and magnesium looks to show their double peaked profile, but it's just marginal detection, so it's difficult to say. And we don't have other lines in the spectrum.
Sorry.
Well, we have only the
calcium lines at the same
point. I see. You're right. Yeah, this is there's a calcium here, and well, it is a more or less flat, I think.
Do you know how this lead spectrum looks of this gamma ray 29 March 2002
Does the light spectrum look like that? Well, I have not seen the nebula spectrum by myself, but I've heard that there is one spectrum taken by several telescopes, and they said that the oxygen, at least the oxygen line emission profile, is very similar to 90 BW.
Okay, so you get a consistent picture.
I hope so.
If I can add something, also the spectrum of, we got the spectrum of 2003 LW, not DH, and that at least you said that is consistent with 90 LW.
That is the other one.
Yes.
The other circle.
Yes.
But I mean, they don't show double peak profiles.
And most of them observing a negative phase.
Excuse me, you published
not in the
spectrum.
No,
that's
the
negative.
Those photospheric, the fake things.
here.
Maybe too far.
But you have to look at the network spectrum.
Was a later spectrum, but not so late, as you know.
More questions?
So in any case, you get a consistent, a very consistent picture with asymmetric.
Yeah, I hope so.
If no more questions, let's see.